Welcome to Relevant Parties by Carhartt Work in Progress. I'm Chelle Ravens, and in this series, I'm going behind the scenes at some of the world's best independent record labels to meet the visionaries and the obsessives who've made musical history. In each episode, we sit down with one of these label founders to find out what makes them tick. We hear the tall tales and big ideas behind some of the most influential records and scenes of the past 30 years, and maybe try to work out just what possessed them to take on one of the most challenging jobs in the music industry. Some of the best independent record labels have captured a specific scene, or a city, or a moment in time, or a musical movement, but some of them are just one person's taste. Unbending and uncompromised by whatever is flavour of the month, and ending up as a kind of fractured musical portrait of the human behind the releases. Darren White, known to everyone as D-Bridge, rose to fame as one quarter of the drum and bass outfit Bad Company, whose creative peak at the turn of the millennium coincided with D&B's brush with the mainstream. But if commercial success had to come at the cost of innovation, then D-Bridge decided he didn't care for it. So he went solo and set up Exit Records in 2003. UK sound system culture was supposed to be about hurtling into the future, about pushing things forward. And even when he scored a huge hit, like his modern D&B classic True Romance, D-Bridge just kept on moving. In the 18 years since Exit began, it's been through many overlapping phases, releasing heavyweight dubstep, hardcore jungle throwbacks, footwork crossovers, and dreamy down-tempo and ambient. And yeah, some pretty serious drum and bass rollers in there too. The whole point for D-Bridge is that the true creative potential of jungle was never fully realised in the 90s. There are still so many avenues to go down. So when D-Bridge teamed up with Instrumental for the Autonomic podcast in 2009, their emotional subversion of drum and bass inadvertently created a new genre. And when a wave of Exit producers started fusing footwork with jungle in the mid-10s, they kicked off a transatlantic conversation that's still shaping the cutting edge of dance music. And after years of pushing his own label signings to the front, D-Bridge has recently reignited his own creativity, and since the emotional odyssey of his 2018 album A Love I Can't Explain, which is one of my favourites on the label, he's put out another 3 albums, and with that has come new bookings and new audiences, proof that dedication to the craft will always trump fleeting fashions. So this is a good time for Exit and a good time for Darren, who's found his groove out in Antwerp, where he lives now with his wife and kids, dividing his time between the school run and the studio. So I interviewed him from his home studio, surrounded by so many synths and lots of tasty gear. And he talked about throwing himself into music after a turbulent childhood, how Bad Company became pioneers of digital technology, and why he went back to his analog machines anyway. And he explained the difficulties of orbiting the drum and bass scene, a world where doing something different isn't always welcomed. And remember, for a more thorough musical introduction, you can dig into the playlist for this episode on Spotify. Just search for Relevant Parties and you'll find music from across the 2 series so far. So I thought perhaps we could just start at the beginning of Exit, which isn't the beginning of your career, but it's a sort of middle point in your longer life's work, I suppose, because it's well into your career as a producer and DJ. But could you just take us back specifically to 2003? What was happening in 2003 for you personally and also in drum and bass in general that led to the beginning of Exit?
2003. So that was, I suppose, a kind of post-BC, really. I was living in Golders Green. I think I'd moved in with Jay and Mick, Maldini and Vegas, from BC, and we were sort of all living together. It was all right, actually. Thinking back on it, it was a good time. We were always hanging out in, like, pretty much hanging out in Hampstead Heath, because Fresh lived up there. You know, Fresh's old man owned a restaurant around there. So it was kind of like it was kind of like just hanging around in the Heath. So it's not a bad place to be. Do you know what I mean?
Lovely, yeah.
But it was kind of like a time in the Bad Company life where things weren't going as well as they were. We'd just been, you know, there was the story that we lost a lot of money through vinyl distribution and pretty much, you know, stolen, like, so something like over 100 grand from us that we were owed. So there was this kind of this feeling of, I think Fresh would have a different view on it, but because he was involved in so much of the early BC, of the BC stuff, he financially lost the most. Mm. Do you know what I mean? So, and I think he was just a bit frustrated with that side of things. And also I know that dynamically we were, especially me, heading in different directions. And I can't remember the exact date. I think like Shot Down on Safari was probably the last album that we'd done. And I just wasn't in it at all. You know, it just wasn't my cup of tea, the way the sound was going and all that. So I was kind of, this isn't really my thing. You know, I'm not really, and I'm not sure how much I want to be a part of it. But I had that difficult dilemma of I was being paid really well, but not enjoying it. You know, going out. So it was this, yeah, going out to parties and just not really, you know, playing music that I wasn't really in and being, I wouldn't say forced, but I suppose in some ways, yeah, we had to represent the BC sound. So, and I wasn't really in it.
When you say about the money, by the way,
yeah,
just to be clear, is that because a distribution company tanked? Or?
Yeah, they basically, there was something shady happened and basically a lot of labels lost a lot of money. So, yeah, so we foolishly, because we were pretty naive, we were kind of like, oh, yeah, we'll get it later kind of thing, because that was, we had two big sources of income. We had the records that we were selling and we had, you know, the DJ career, but we were sort of so young and enjoying flying around the world and being looked after and that whole side of things that we forgot about that side of it, forgot what we were owed kind of thing. And then it suddenly was like, oh, shit, it's not there anymore. And the fact that we were kind of growing apart, it was suddenly this, like, okay, well, thinking about what's going ahead, we could have done with that, do you know what I mean? So that we can all sort of go off and maybe do some things. So Dan sort of, I think Dan was like, Fresh was working with Adam F at the time and they kind of hit it off. And that was when the kind of thing, it did a breakbeat punk or something, I can't remember the name of the label he did. He did a Mutant X, I think, was on there. And I could just see that Dan was like, right, not so much like, I don't really need you guys, but yeah, I don't really need you guys. Do you know what I mean? I can, I can go off and do my own thing. And I just want to, he wanted to explore that direction more than the rest of us. So he kind of left, and me, Jay and Mick, we kind of like, all right, are we going to carry on with this? So we did. But in the back of my mind, it was always like, I'm not really sure if this is what I want to do. Do you know what I mean? I think we just done like Bullet Time was the first thing we'd done really without Dan, the Bullet Time EP. And it did well. It did well for us. But there was like, you know, like I say, living in Golders Green, I was just going down to the end, going to the Swerve and getting enamored with that sound and what was going on with there. I was feeling a lot more connection with that. And that really sort of made me think, you know what, I need to be able to express myself, because I just felt I was getting, because I was becoming less and less involved in BC tunes, I was getting lost, you know what I mean? And I didn't, and it was frustrating for me. Also around that time, my kind of, my brother, Steve Spacek, was, I think it was around the time he did the Vintage High Tech album for K7, and I was helping him out on that. So I was just kind of like, it was all, you know, it was just this whole new thing of like hanging out with him. He was introducing me to like Dilla and all this stuff. And I was just kind of like, okay, this is what I'm feeling. And it was just like, just sort of reminding me that just that for the love of music again, just reminding me what, you know, what was out there and what I felt a connection with. So yeah, it was just kind of a really mixed time, really. I think we were kind of, it was, I just remember being really frustrated a lot, really. I think that was the main sort of feeling I had. And I remember, you know, the conversations that I had with Jay and Mick, and we were like, look, I want to do my own thing. I want to do my own releases, solo releases, but I'd like to do them on BC recordings. And that just, they just like, nah. So, I really couldn't get my head around like why that wouldn't be a thing. Do you know what I mean? Why that wouldn't be okay. But for whatever reason, they weren't really into the idea. Because I always saw it as almost like, I think I've said it before, like, you know, like how Full Cycle, you know, they were a collective, but there were individuals within that collective well, and they were all releasing on the same label. So I wanted the same thing. And they were just like, nah. So it was almost like my hand was forced, maybe.
So that's why it's called Exit, then?
People have asked that. and maybe subconsciously it is.
It's like you just saying bye.
Pretty much, yeah. But I kind of, you know, at the time I always had this thing in my head because I was loving going to Japan. And I always, for some reason, just that logo and seeing it in these doorways. And I always had, yeah, I'm going to take loads of pictures of this logo in different, and those are going to be the sleeve covers. And that's going to be it. But probably deep down, it was me just being like, I'm out of here kind of thing. And I do think sometimes in hindsight, whether I would have called the label Exit, but I'm kind of stuck with it now. So.
No, it's good. And it's suitably vague for the many shapes in which you have bent the contents, if you know what I mean. Like, it doesn't necessarily say this is what we do, which has probably turned out to be quite useful.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I kind of wanted to get at this point a little bit, actually. So you've obviously, you yourself have taken on various different aliases and projects. You've done loads of collaborations, and they've kind of been like these mini eras within Exit, I guess. You've had like the sort of Mosaic compilation and Autonomic, and then Pleasure District, and these different kind of things that have obviously piqued your interest at different points. And I guess I just wanted to like highlight the kind of context for that, and think about why you feel like you've needed to create all these different like signposts and labels. Because I think it feels to me as if you're trying to be like in communication with the audience, with like the record buyer, to be very like clear about what they can expect, which perhaps to me says something about like drum and bass audiences needing to know what to expect. Like you've really clarified, like, this is this project, this is that sound, in a way that I think a lot of other record labels maybe just wouldn't bother doing. They would just put stuff out.
I don't know if I've ever that purposeful with it. I think it's my main thing is signing music and being into music that I connect with and that I'm interested in, and that's, you know, and it's, I think what it is, or maybe I don't want to say get bored easily, but I just want to find something that piques my interest. So I think it's good to sort of frame things, definitely, which is why, especially with like Autonomic, it was like, you know, here's a sound that we wanted to present to people, you know, us and me and Instrumental. So let's do this podcast and let's just do like just 12 so we don't, you know, overkill it.
It's like you're making music but feeling very aware of the fact that there is someone listening to it and that you might need to actually, you know, give a context of what you're doing. Not everybody does that. You know, I wondered if you think very much about like who the sort of Exit hardcore fan is.
No, and I think in some ways that's my biggest problem, that I don't think, because it's like most of the things I do for me and for the artists that are involved. I want them to kind of release what they believe in. It's like, it's why I don't get involved in an artist's album or in terms of direction or A&Ring as such. It's like, because this is you and I want you to represent you. And I don't like the, because I'm a producer as well, I don't like the idea of someone telling me how to do what I'm doing. So the struggle I've had, I think, is that for me, Exit isn't a D&B label, but it's always been perceived that way. And that, if anything, that's the ongoing battle I've had with the audience out there. But listen, guys, it's not, you know, I have to keep reminding people that Black Pockets, Deep Space, it was the first album that released, you know, it's basically a hip-hop album. You know, and if you look at the rest, you know, things like They Live, Dan Harbinum. I didn't really want to conform to what D&B was, but underlying, obviously, it has that base. But I think we've tried to show what D&B can do and is possible. So yeah, it's just this real struggle that I have. It's an internal struggle of like, no, we're not a D&B label, but I love D&B. But, you know, so it's this weird ongoing thing. Like, even like, you know, I've just released a pretty much a D&B album and it's done well. It's done well for the label. And it's like slightly frustrating that it has done well. But it's like, it's like, yeah, cool. Of course it is, because we can do that. What I do like, I know, is that I like projects. I like working on projects and then seeing them through and then not really worrying too much about the end result, but just kind of like, hey, why don't we do this? You know, for example, like the Richie Brains project, it was a kind of like, I knew that I was working with artists that there was had the similar thread between them, Fixate, Fracture, Om Unit, Stray. There was this similarity and I was just like, well, it'd be really good if you all sort of formed and did some music together. And that project took, from when it was initially started to when it actually finished, it was like 3, maybe 4 years it took to finish. We were okay with that. It was like, there's no need to rush it kind of thing. It was like, when you got time. And then, you know, we spoke about what this project was, and it just sort of, everything sort of happened naturally. And the same with Binary Collective, which was me, Kid Drama, Consequence, Joe Seven. Yeah, that's it. Just double check it. And we were, again, we just kind of like going with an idea and then see where that idea takes us. And that, you know, that idea was that, okay, we're writing a soundtrack for a movie that doesn't exist. And it worked. So, and then we were able to frame that in that kind of, you know, in that context. So I think we don't go in with that intention, I think, but I suppose it does sort of form that way.
Yeah. That looking back into the sort of earlier days of, or the first half of Exit, one of the biggest hits of those times is a track called Marker with Dub Physics and Skeptical and vocals from Strategy. Can you tell me a bit about the story of that one? Because I think it's certainly not like a straight up drum and bass track, is it? So what was it doing at the time? Like, why do you think that particular track kind of had the impetus behind it?
I was just talking to Skeppy the other day about this, actually, because we had a chat. And it was, again, it was just one of these natural kind of things, because Ash started it. And I think he started it in around maybe April of the year it came out, and then sent it to George because they were doing stuff together. And I think George just sat on it for ages. And then literally him and Strats were in a session one day, got it up, and it just clicked. Do you know what I mean? It was done really quickly. And I had it for, it felt like I had it for ages. They said it was done the same year it came out, but I don't think so. I feel like I had it for a good year or so. And it was just something that I had that I was playing out, and it was causing trouble. You know, people were like, what is this? And it was good because, you know, the festival Sun and Bass in Sardinia, it was like a, you know, the soundtrack of that 1 year. And then you used to, what was that club we used to play? Cable. Down in London Bridge, I can't remember whose night. I think it might have even been our nights. A bunch of cuts. Maybe we were doing that there. Yeah, it was just going off, this track.
Was this before you decided to release it even? You were just a track that you had?
Yeah, it wasn't. I was more in the B-side at the time, Rags. I thought the B-side was so much better. and I still do. equally that track was also a big tune as well. But yeah, we kind of like, I remember when we were putting it out, because it was like, oh, we need to get this out before the end of the year. And I think it was, and then the release date was coming in, oh, it's going to be in December. And it was like, well, December's a tricky time to release music. You know, it's like coming up to Christmas, or it's, people aren't necessarily buying music. But then it was just like, do you know what? Sod it. We should. And it was one of those tracks as well, which for some reason it took on a life of its own in terms of like everyone getting behind it, like from the audience and all DJs, producers, and everyone just like really sharing it when it came out on you know, when the video, when that came out, and when the tune was actually released, we were just kind of like, whoa, what is going on? That's like, everyone is sharing this tune, everyone's playing it, you know, we're getting playlisted and all this kind of stuff. And we're like, okay, this is doing all right, this tune. And yeah, it was, I loved that it just came out at the, you know, especially at the end of the year, and came out after the Drum and Bass Arena Awards for that year, and it was clearly the biggest tune of the year. And it's one of those tunes as well. It's still selling to this day. My label manager keeps telling you it's just the gift that keeps on giving. It's just kind of like, I'm always kind of like, when their statements coming out, I've got to do their voice, and I'm like, really? How much? It's still selling. Like, okay, cool. So, yeah, it was a big point, I suppose, in some ways, in terms of, you obviously, we hadn't had anything as big as that, and probably haven't had since, really, I suppose. But it was kind of like, that was the label's sort of here, you know, stamping, kind of like, yeah, we're, this is a label to be, to, for people to take note of. And probably as well added the belief that it was a DMB label. So,
I mean, with the success of a track like that, did you then think, okay, we should probably go in this direction, and in that case, perhaps return to being a more, I mean, not necessarily accessible label, but certainly have bigger kind of commercial targets?
I don't think I ever think that way. I think I'm lucky in a sense, because I'm DJing, I was getting sent all this stuff. So I was able to kind of pick up on things quite early and things that I potentially wanted or wanted to sign. Mm. But I'm always quite drawn to, I'm not really into sort of obvious things. So when, like, you know, with a track like Mark, and then suddenly, like, people sending you these, you know, 100 versions of it, it's like, I don't need this. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's kind of been done. So it's, no, I think, like I said, being sent all this music, I was able to kind of like, all right, that's cool, you know, and find stuff that, which was getting a response, I suppose, on the dance floor. And so I suppose in that way, yeah, you kind of maybe not so much commercially thinking, but you're looking at what works, and what where the response is at. So that can maybe be, okay, what this guy's doing is, you know, is interesting, and is, people are liking it. But I don't think we ever kind of like I say, I don't tell my artists to kind of like, you need to do this again. And because I don't think that's healthy, and I don't think any of them want to do it, because I've never really wanted to do it within myself.
Because you've almost had the same type of experience where with True Romance, which is one of your like huge tunes, I guess you had a choice to make more of those. You could have gone and recycled that success to some extent.
Yeah, I could have. I think, you know, I've done a couple of VIPs and always kind of regretted it, but the thing is, the VIP for me, it just fixed some problems that the original had, so that's why I kind of did it. And then the next VIP I did is just because I was going back to back with Goldie, and I just needed something to hurt him. But other than that, it's like I've never touched, I don't think I've ever used that bass sound again. And I know I could quite easily just have rolled out another 10 or 15 especially within DMB, because DMB does kind of have this thing of repeating itself somewhat. If something catches on, you tend to hear, you know, a fair few versions of that thing.
Yeah,
but I don't want sort of, I that doesn't sort of turn me on as such. So it's like when I look for when I'm finding artists or when I'm working for you, I like what they're into and their sound, and I don't need to then find another artist that sounds like that artist, because it's just not, it's not helpful for them as well. Do you know what I mean? If you've got, say, like two or three different artists all doing similar things, I don't think it's healthy. So
it's also one of those tracks though, that if you look around on forums for like making tunes, people are still asking those questions, you know, I want to get the bass on True Romance. Does anyone know how to do this kind of thing? It's got that kind of life to it.
Yeah. Well, I might, I don't know, I might NFT it or something. That seems quite popular now. NFT, the preset.
Yeah, definitely. But specifically just the bass line. Yeah, not the track, just the bass line.
Yeah, I think I might do that.
That would be good. All right, let's do the full rewind and get a little bit of your own background in there, because I think you have quite an interesting background. You come from a musical family, as they say. So there's your brother, Steve, who is a renowned musician in his own right, as Steve Spacek. And your dad was a reggae singer, right?
Yeah. It wasn't necessarily accomplished, but he is definitely a reggae singer and has had had releases. Well, I didn't grow up with my brother. It's kind of like I'm the love child of my dad. So there's my dad had my brother and his sister, and then I came along, and then the rest of the sort of family came along. So I grew up with my mum. I lived with her for 11 years. That was a sort of up and down sort of life. Basically, I was fostered. I was in children's homes. So it's kind of like, and I left home when I was 11. My memories of her are there, but I wouldn't say necessarily they're great memories. Do you know what I mean? You know, I do always remember she had like the old sort of stereo system, and it was, you know, she was into like John Holt and Dennis Brown and Sugar Hill Gang. And those were kind of all the records I remember from her. But I didn't really have a connection with music until I kind of moved out and went to live with my auntie and uncle in Malvern when I was around 11. And when I studied in secondary school, that was when I started to get into music, really. And that was through the obvious channels at the time, which was Pepsi Chart Show, Smash Hits. I remember my little cousin used to get Smash Hits magazine. They used to have a read of that with the flexi discs on the front occasionally. I think I didn't really form my own tastes until like The Doors and the Jimi Hendrix. I think I went through that phase.
Oh, right.
Actually, to be fair, I do, like, my auntie and uncle were really, they were like rock and rollers, and they used to constantly like that, the Everly Brothers and all that 60s stuff, Eddie Cochran. So I grew up on a lot of that as well. So maybe there is that kind of, because it was so exposed to so much different stuff, is kind of why I'm not so focused on one thing, I suppose. So I think, yeah, sort of Hendrix and The Doors. I was really into The Doors. I loved Jim Morrison. Almost obsessed. Where we was in Malvern, it wasn't really a great deal going on. So we all used to just kind of go down, it was the Nag's Head or the Morgan, and it was like the jukeboxes there. And then the Morgan was more sort of pop, and they had like Duran Duran, that kind of stuff on there, Depeche Mode. And that, I think, well, my love for that grew from that jukebox. The Nag's Head was more of a biker's pub. And that was all about sort of Iron Maiden, Megadeth, AC/DC.
Did you have a metal phase then?
Yeah, I loved it. Well, my next door neighbor as well, he got me into like Napalm Death and things like that. So then I think really where I was like, okay, this is me. What do I connect with from my generation was as when the whole Manchester thing sort of really, like Stone Roses, Wonder Stuff, Charlatans, all that kind of stuff was coming through. I was like, okay, this is, they're talking to me now. You know, that was the connection I was getting with those guys. Public Image, Pogues, Chapter House, the sort of guitar janglers, Head Down, you know, shoegaze. Love that stuff. My Bloody Valentine. I think having all of that around me, you know, Prince and everything, just, you know, I think I'm really open to so much stuff as a result.
At what point did you start getting kind of influenced by what your brother was listening to?
Well, I left my auntie and uncle in the early 90s. I think it would have been 1991, and I had to move back to London. And so that was, I was then living with another auntie then. And I was just basically, I was a teenager doing teenager things that they weren't quite ready to deal with. Do you know what I mean? So
you were getting in trouble.
Yeah, I wasn't, not anything serious. I was smoking weed kind of thing, things like that. Do you know what I mean? They just didn't want it around their kids kind of thing, which is fair enough. So then I kind of lived with my other auntie in Croydon, in Addiscombe. I went to, what's that, Selhurst College for a while. I was studying real-time computer systems.
Wow.
Yeah, I was learning like COBOL, Pascal, all these different languages. And my dream at that time was to go, I went for the interview at whatever, the Bristol University originally, no, it was the Polytechnic that they had then. And I was on route to do it. My grades were doing all right, grades were good. And then I kind of linked up with my brother and he started taking me out. And then I was like, actually,
wow.
Actually, do you know what? This music thing's all right. He started taking me out. We used to like Roast, Laserdrome, in Peckham, over in Lee Valley, Desert Storm. I had to move out of my auntie and uncle's. And he said, you know, come and live with me. So I lived there, basically lived there on a mattress in the flat with him, my brother, and a guy called Frank. Because there was only a two bedroom, so I used to kind of like swap rooms as the witch, you know, move my mattress depending on who had a girl over, kind of thing. But Steve, that was around the time of Curvature, the album he was doing with Ireland. So yeah, he'd had a publishing advance and basically bought all this equipment. I was just kind of like, this guy's a G, basically. You know, he's like making this amazing music on the and he's like, all right, I'm buying all this stuff, come, let's, you know, let's show me how to use it, let's do some stuff, you know what I mean, let's work it out. And that was kind of, that was it for me, the whole computer thing. I was like, nah.
But presumably you had that kind of technical aptitude for the machines in some way.
Yeah, I think that definitely helped, because I knew my way around all these kind of stuff, around OSs and what was going on. And I was a quick learner with that kind of stuff as well, so it wasn't, you know, the whole thing wasn't foreign to me. So yeah, learning how to use the Akai sampler and learning how to use Cubase and the Atari was like, yeah, this isn't a problem for me.
So I mean, we have to sort of steam through this section a little bit to get to Exit. But so you and Steve put out a record as the Sewer Monsters.
Yeah, it says that. It says the Sewer Monsters. It's actually the Sewage Monsters. But for some reason, I don't know why it says Sewer.
Yeah, right. It's got like a mistake on it, hasn't it? Yeah. It's got like, it's listed in Discogs. So the Sewage Monsters.
Yeah, the Sewage Monsters, which was me, Steve and Frank. Just had the one release, I think we did. Yeah, the one release. And then we were, and there was a guy called Gary, GMC Blood for real. He was involved as well. And then me and him started doing a thing called Dub Hustlers, and he knew Lenny the Ice. And that was my connection with that. And then I used to go down to Lenny's studio, Arms House Crew, and all those guys. And it's like PSG and Timmy Magic hanging out around there. And yeah, kind of like that sort of led me to discovering the world of Music House, because I used to go down there and they knew Leon and Paul and a guy Junior who run the label that I think was like Do or Die, and I think he was helping out with Arms House as well. They were all interconnected, so I was kind of like, I was the sort of the quiet kid in the background, just sort of tagging along and soaking it all up. And then a mutual friend of mine and Jason's introduced me to Jason, because Jason was already working down at Trouble on Vinyl, Maldini, and that was my sort of, that's how we linked up. And that would have been 94, 95. So then me and Jason started working together, and then that was Future Forces. From Future Forces we started Hardware, and it just sort of, yeah. And then Fresh came down to the studio one day, and that's how we met him, and then, you know, moved on to BC. So yeah, that's the quick version of it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we may as well, we're gonna have to condense it a bit. But with BC, with Bad Company, it does strike me like you do enjoy a collaboration, but making drum and bass with four people does seem like it would be quite complicated. Just a lot of people. How did you even divide up all the like duties? Was it just like you, one person would be sitting in the corner doing a bass line?
The early days, the first album, it was all four of us. We basically were hanging out in Dan's mum's house for a summer and pretty much wrote that inside the machine. And then after that, because obviously we all lived different places, the studio that we were using was in Dan's house in Hampstead. So we'd have to travel up there. But obviously, whilst we're not there, Dan's still writing music. So, and then sometimes I can't make it, or Jay will go up. So it was kind of like, we kind of decided quite after Inside the Machine, and once the ball had started rolling in terms of like, oh, people are into what we were doing, it's like, well, it doesn't really matter who's involved, kind of thing. As long as there's music being written, it can all go out under the name Bad Company. And then with the credits, we'll deal with that later, kind of thing. But I just think it maybe kind of got in the way in some respects, whereby, because, you know, there'd be times when, especially because of the advent of the internet and AIM, you know, AOL kind of thing, people were able to get hold of things a lot quicker. So there was like, you could go out the studio, write a tune with, you know, Dan would stay up longer, and by the time you were up, Andy C already had it. Do you know what I mean? It was like, whoa. And it was always like,
and you haven't really had
keys.
The sign off then.
Yeah, so it was just kind of like, also a lot of times you'd wake up and it'd be a completely different tune, some of the same samples,
yeah,
and Andy C would have it. So it was like, okay, it's just getting out of control a little bit. So it did, yeah, working with, it doesn't always work.
Yeah, the amount of records that you put out in the space of a few years though is pretty incredible. I mean, there I can see the advantage of having four people available.
yeah. No, it was we were very prolific, and it was, yeah, it helped. You know, not all of it was good, but it all helped a common cause kind of thing, you know.
I was reading this old conversation between Simon Reynolds and Mark Fisher. It's from 2010, and they're talking a lot about the kind of change in dance music from the 90s into the noughties. Simon Reynolds has this, he says at one point, in the 90s, the whole culture was tilted forwards. And I was thinking about that and like the kind of prolific nature of Bad Company, and was wondering, did you feel that way in the 90s, especially, that you were kind of rushing towards the future in some way musically?
Yeah, I think so. We always wanted to be, I know as a group, we always wanted to be on the cutting edge, whether that was, you know, we started off with very sort of analog, but we very much embraced the whole digital in the box aspect. Mm. We'd go down to, what was it, Turnkeys, I think it was, on Oxford Street. We'd spent so much in that shop. Just like, what's the latest bit of kit? You know, what's we need? And I think it was like, was it the Roland VP3 something, some weird very phrase sampler? It's like, yeah, we've got to have that. I think we might have used it on one track. I think it's us and the Chemical Brothers, I think, were the only people who'd bought it. I think it was like really, so quite this abstract bit of kit. But yeah, we were very much about like pushing forward, even like with when we started Digital Nation, which intended to be the live version of BC. It was kind of like, you know, we wanted to embrace all that technology had to offer and to use it to our advantage. I think the advent of AIM really changed things, because that instantaneous nature of being able to get things to people quickly, and CDJs, when that's the advent of that sort of, you know, started taking off as well. Because in terms, in D&B, we were one of the first people to start using CDJs. The fact we used to take them with us, we were just making things, and we wanted to like, right, we want to test this out tonight. I want to play this out. Like going down to Music House, waiting to cut a dub. And then it was just like, no, we don't need to do that. Burn a CD and then take it with us. And we used to get cussed out so hard. People used to give us so much shit. Why are you bawling bloody
fire?
Wow. So like, and it was in our head, it was like, you'll see. You know, and we were, I think, you know, we were right. You know, we took it on tour to like New Zealand and all kinds of places, and just got so much flack all over the world. But yeah, I think, you know, CDJs, AIM, the instantaneous nature of things really kind of pushed things forward in terms of how things were done. And in negatively as well, because of kind of that filter of time of being able to sit with something wasn't really there anymore, kind of thing. It was like, oh, right, yeah, cool, this works. Sick, let's get it out, or let's do that again, kind of thing. So it was like, in some respects, quality control might have gone down as a result, because you'd give anything a go. But maybe that was to, you know, maybe it is an advantage that I don't see. I don't know.
To go back to this quite interesting little interview that I was reading recently between Simon Reynolds and Mark Fisher. So then after Simon Reynolds talks about this idea of like being tilted towards the future, mm-hmm. Mark Fisher says, the problem is that the word futuristic no longer has a connection with any future that anyone expects to happen. In the 70s, futuristic meant synthesizers. In the 80s, it meant sequences and cut and paste montage. In the 90s, it meant the abstract digital sounds open up by the sampler and its functions, such as time stretching. Through sound, we got a taste of a world that would be completely different. Now futuristic is a style, like a font. I just felt that there was something about that that like that reflects a little sense from the 2000s onward that not specifically drum and bass, but sort of dance music in general had somehow lost its steam. Like, tell me about that, because obviously that's when Exit appears, and I don't know if that's something that you felt at the time or...
Yeah, no, it's an interesting way of viewing it, I suppose. Yeah, he's right. And I think as a result, that kind of looking backwards is what then becomes the futuristic approach. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like, okay, what maybe have we missed from our past that we could maybe explore more and almost maybe explore a different future? Do you know what I mean? Take an alternative timeline as such. And I think especially that with Autonomic, because that had very much, you know, connections with... the 80s and
right.
hardware and synthesizers. It was kind of like, okay, where can we, it was almost like, I remember we were like, what would happen if DMB went in this mm-hmm. direction? And we explored that. And I think, especially I say, cause I was going down to Swerve and hearing those kind of things, hearing, you know, and what Marcus and was doing with Solar. And it was these different sort of directions that were being taken, and that's what I liked about DMB, I think, especially because it does go off in so many different has all these different subgenres and whatnot, and it's like, but there's some real sort of people really exploring some different avenues, and that was where it was where people were doing that, and it was I wanted to do that with Exit. I think I wanted to explore the, you know, what I felt should be going on. So I suppose in that sense, you know, that this is the future I want for DMB. And people, there were, like I said, Solar and Caliber, you know, Signature, and, you know, we're also exploring that as well. I have a hard time with DMB because it goes in directions, and I'm kind of like, no, that's no, you're going, no, not that way, this way. So there's, you know, I try to explore those other paths and find artists who have that kind of similar sensibility.
You were saying that, you know, Bad Company were really ahead of the game when it came to going digital, making music in the box, using CDJs, but then you basically stepped away from that and went back to all your hardware stuff, right?
Yeah, because it was...
almost as if you're like reviving those old tools to build that different future or something.
Yeah, because it was everything was becoming, I don't know, it was just, it's like what I connect with, and I wasn't really connecting with it. And it was, I could see as well, there was this kind of technology was taking over in terms of Pendulum were the biggest thing at the time, and how their sound was what people were chasing, you know, and how to sound like them. And people trying to work out, well, what plugin are they using? What compressor? It's just kind of like, their snares are at 200 hertz. I was like, oh my God, I really don't care about that. And it's like, that was when it almost like the futurism of it, or the technology was getting in the way of what was going on. And that just didn't sit with me, which is why, you know, when I hooked up with Instra, and then went down to the studio and just saw all this equipment, and just kind of like, ah, okay. Seeing a mixing desk, it reminded me of my past and the real hands-on nature. I missed that because I was in this DMB group with everyone sort of looking over at someone's shoulder, kind of like, no, do that. It's just kind of like, this isn't... I just felt, you know, find myself sat at the back smoking a spliff, just kind of like... nodding my head. It's like, this isn't making music, you know, this isn't what I want for me. So yeah, seeing like a rack of synths there, and that's probably why my studio is like it's because I like that, you know, that I can have people come around and they can play on that stuff, I can play on this stuff, you can do this, and there's that real interaction. And especially just with, you know, with their approach and their ear, it's like, yeah, they've got a real ear for it. And it's like they're not afraid of key changes and chords, and do you know what I mean? It's and some, a bit more, you know, some emotiveness in what's going on.
You know, a lot of labels and some of the labels that I've talked to in the series, they might represent like a scene, a moment in time, you know, or like a particular genre, or they can just be one person's taste. And I think that's what Exit is, really. But it's a funny kind of label to run, because it means that you have to be very confident in your own taste at all times, even when that's going kind of against the grain of what other people thing that they're doing. And I do notice that in the many interviews with you that I've read, you do tend to be somewhat self-deprecating about your achievements and so on. And I just wonder, like, that idea of having to have total confidence in what you're releasing, like, do you always have that confidence?
Yeah, I do. Because my one thing is almost like I don't want to look back over my catalogue and be like, oh, I wish I hadn't done that. I have to have that confidence in what I'm releasing, or, you know, the producers I'm into. So it's my taste. And I appreciate that not everyone is into it or gets it. And I'm okay with that. You know, it's like, I've got, you know, there's plenty of releases on this label that, you know, you have to talk until from a financial sense, have done terrible, but I don't care. Mm. I really don't care. Cause it's kind of like, I'm really into what that guy's or that person's produced, you know? And it's, if I'm into a certain person's sound, then I want you to do you. And I want to be able to give you a platform to do that. I'm always looking for something, just something different. Something I get bored really quickly. I think that's my problem. Because of DMB just gets really sort of, is it self-referential? Just really sort of just copies itself. It's like, oh, come on, guys. But I know as a label as well, you know, in myself, I've wanted big things for the label. You know, I've always, when I started out, my influences as a label were sort of XL, Talking Loud, FFRR, you know, Warp. Those are the labels that I look up to. Those are that in my head is like, I'd love to be one of those kind of labels one day, a strong independent. I think sticking to just one thing was never really something I felt would push me along that path, you know, to be that kind of label. I wanted to be more open, and I wanted it to be representative of who I am and what I'm into. My label sort of changes direction constantly. And it's in, again, even like, you know, the next few releases, it's going to again. It's like, and I'm probably going to piss off a lot of my audience again, but it's like, I'm sorry. you should be used to it by now in some respects, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of related to that, but I wanted to talk a bit more about Autonomic, because layer one of Autonomic, so Autonomic is a podcast in theory, although I guess people, it's funny, isn't it? People don't use that word for that type of thing anymore. It's a mix series, I guess. But at the time, you could call it a podcast. And layer one of this 12-part series begins actually with a couple of tracks from Jimmy Edgar. That in itself feels like quite a sort of pointed way to open a set, because he's like this, you know, funky, kind of like slightly like sleazy electro, very like melodic, catchy type of music. And then it goes into the sort of broader concept of Autonomic. But I mean, yeah, well, I almost feel like you're trying to make a specific connection there, which maybe travels through some of your more recent music as well, where it's like stuff like, you know, Detroit music, funky music. Like, was that something you were trying to bring people back towards in some way?
What we did, what we knew we wanted to do was kind of like, let's let people know what our influences are. And I think the influences were equally as important as everything else. Because especially it sounded like in DMB as well, everyone was just really guarded about, you know, where they would get, what they're into, it seemed.
And really?
Just kind of like, or what they were sampling. They didn't want other people to know where they were getting their sounds from or what was influencing what they were doing. And it was just kind of like, no, sod that. Like, this is, people need to understand and connect the dots in some ways, that we felt that there was this lineage of what these influences were and the music that we're producing now. It was, yeah, that was really important. That's like, you know, if you look at my selection as well, my influences, it goes, you know, the Carpenter stuff, John Carpenter or Stone Roses, The Cure, all that kind of stuff is like, it has had an influence on me and still does to this day. So, you know, with Damon and Al, the whole, you know, Detroit thing was, you know, that sound sort of in Damon, especially like with Orteca and Square Pusher and stuff like that. And Damon, I mean, Al was very, really into the sort of like that's like the Jimmy Edgar stuff and sort of sleazy electro. And it was like, if you listen to their tunes and our tunes, you can hear all of that. So we just wanted to be really honest about what we're into and why we make what we make. So to kind of open ourselves up to that and open people up to that and open people up to other kinds of music as well. Because another sort of, I'm shitting on D&B here, but if you're into D&B, you're only into D&B. Do you know what I mean? And that was the attitude. And it was kind of like, come on, look, there's more to it than that. And I think as well, it definitely came along at a time when, you know, dubstep had started, and it was this sort of, you could see the splinter as well from artists like, you know, people were sending us stuff like Pearson Sound, Scuba, you know, Scream, James Blake, and, you know, all these people sending, you could see that they were finding their feet and finding connect and moving off as well. You know, they'd started in D&B and were moving off into what they were feeling as well. So it was like, I suppose it's quite freeing for some people. Like even just today, like talking to Ollie Scream, he's kind of like, yeah, that moment in time is just amazing. I just love it. It's one of the best moments in time for me musically. I love that we, you know, we were able to, it's had that effect on people.
Could you just actually recap the sort of autonomic concept? And I guess I'm interested in how the idea for autonomic fed into Exit, because I mean, in many ways, it was quite a short period of time, I guess. It was only really a few years, but then you had this compilation. And tell me about kind of integrating that into what you were doing on Exit. Well, tell me about the sound first.
I don't know what the sound is. We're still trying to work it. I think it's funny. Some people sort of feel like they know what autonomic is this, and it's kind of like reverse engineering, kind of like, oh, it's you know, it's fifths and it's these kind of Yamaha DX7 cork stuff. And it's like, no, it's that's not what it is. It's, I think, emotion, having something with emotion, a bit something with some feeling and some honesty in it. That was what we, you know, we were trying to convey. You know, Damon and Al might have different thoughts on it, but, you know, this whole thing of it becoming a genre as such, it's like, that was never the intention. So it doesn't really feel like that to me. It was just kind of like a moment, like I say, a moment in time, but it was just, I don't know, things we were exploring. There was sound that we were exploring and we didn't really know what it was. You know, we wanted to write as well. We wanted to kind of like write pop tunes and things like that. And you can kind of see the connection in terms of there's some similarities as well from what the Autonomic was doing and some pop that you can hear now. It's not that dissimilar, you know?
Yeah.
But in terms of Exit, that was another struggle I had in a sense, because I was almost like, because, you know, Instrumental had their own things going on. You know, they were wanting to do less sort of 170 and they were going more, especially if, you know, the Resolution 653 album is different sort of geared, you know, the 130, whatever, I don't know what that genre is, but that style of music. So in some senses, I did feel a bit of a responsibility to kind of, there were all these artists producing this really cool stuff in the 85-170 vein that didn't really have anyone to represent them. I suppose in some ways Mosaic filled that void, I think, that was there. Because we'd started the Autonomic label and we only had like 5 releases on it, I think. But yeah, Damon and Al were just kind of like, no, would you know what? Al especially was like, nah, I'm done with it. He's like, I don't want to have any of it. So he was like, he just went off in his own direction. Damon moved to Australia and then I was kind of left with this.
And you were left with all these tracks.
I was left with all this great music and all these really cool producers. And it was like, I've got this so much cool stuff here. How am I going to get this out? Or had the people, because I want people to hear this. And the compilation just seemed like the easiest way, I suppose, to kind of, rather than doing sort of in, you know, staggering these releases over X amount of years, I was able to kind of condense it a bit. The people who were sort of sending me stuff were also, you know, just developing in their own way as well and exploring new things. So it definitely led on to kind of the directions that, you know, Exit was going, is going.
Yeah. And then after that for you, so then you had the Heart Drive project and also the Velvet alias, which is like your house alias.
Yeah.
So it feels as if both of those things, you know, Autonomic was perhaps a springboard for both of them in different ways, because to suddenly decide, okay, fuck it, I'm going to do some house records, is obviously quite a switch up. Although you didn't end up putting all of those out on Exit, did you, the Velvet? Like they went elsewhere.
Yeah, I think I did one on Exit. It was like a, this itch that needed to be scratched, I suppose. From a personal point of view, I was quite lost, I think. I didn't know what I wanted to do. Because I knew I was really into what we were doing as Autonomic. I had visions in my head of what it could be. So yeah, I think I sort of buried myself in other people's music and putting other people's music out. My DJing was getting, you know, was obviously really picking up as well. And I was getting sent so much cool music and playing all this stuff and like, right, yeah, I want to sign. That's amazing. I want to sign that. And then what I was doing was just kind of getting pushed further and further back. And then it was the whole thing of the stuff that I'm playing and the stuff that I'm putting out just sonically just sounds. I was getting into that old thing of what the problem that would sort of the early BC kind of thing, or that sonically it was just sounding so much better than anything I could do. So I was just kind of losing confidence in my own music as a result. So I think there was a big gap where I didn't release anything for a while. But I obviously still making music, but making music for me just got, you know, that sort of selfish, sort of therapeutic, get me through the week kind of thing. Come the weekend, it was like, yeah, sick. You know, I've got new Skeppy, new Fixate, all this cool stuff. So it was another sort of difficult balancing act of things going really well because of the label, but me personally just feeling quite down about everything because I'm not actually... that, you know, that, like I say, not that confident in my own music anymore. So that I had to kind of fight through that for a while.
When did that change?
Probably, I think, and when I decided to do my album, because my label manager was like, you need to do another album. I'm like, okay. I was like, no. He's like, you need to do another album. I'm like, oh, God's sake. Then it was kind of like dragged on for a while. And then it was like, oh, actually, do you know what? I'm in a place now. I think I'd moved here to Antwerp with my wife. So I was kind of like, in some ways I'd separated myself from the rest of the musical world. You know, it's just about me here, family. And that was all and those were the influences around me. So I think I was a lot more settled within myself. It was, you know, I'd only go out on the weekends and, you know, occasionally see some of my people be going to all these different places. So I think once I came here and settled and I wasn't as influenced by everything, then I kind of chilled out a bit, I think, really. You know, my wife and my kids kind of gave me that confidence in myself again to be like, you know what, just do you. That's when sort of, you know, A Love I Can't Explain sort of came about. And then literally that, I think in some ways that probably opened the floodgates in terms of like, oh, okay. Because as well, I think because of that uncertainty of what I was doing, it was releasing it and having people critique it was a problem that I needed to get over. It was like, I think most musicians probably do, or producers, it's like, I'm not making this for you, so I don't really want to know what you think about it. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, my wife was like, it'd be fine, just get it out there, stop worrying. And it was, and I think it was just like, that thing of her sort of learning to let go is and not be so bothered about what other people think and what they might think of it or how it compares to this, you know, sonically amazing piece of music, because it doesn't. It's a different thing, and me having to realize it that it's a different thing and not make those comparisons. So, and that wasn't even that long ago, wasn't it? It was just maybe like a year.
Yeah, before. It was only a couple of years ago, and now you've done like three more.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
the floodgates opened.
It pretty much was, and I think I just learned the art of letting go. But I think also, I did miss, and I do miss sort of like, you know, we're talking earlier about collaborations, and I think I'm almost happier in those kind of situations. I think I prefer working with people, and that's probably why those points in my career have always been quite. Are the sort of main, you know, highlights, so to speak, are the collaborations because I enjoy that so much, and because there's in some ways it's a not as much stress in that respect, you know. So I can concentrate on what I'm good at, and if I'm working with Skeptical, I know that the mix is going to sound sick, so I don't have to worry about that. I haven't got that pressure anymore.
And you actually appear on a good amount of Exit releases. You're there, even if it's like you're, you know, collaborating on track 4 or something. You do actually crop up quite often in the catalogue, which is quite nice.
Yeah, I do. I just love working with people. I get a real buzz out of it because I just constantly learning. And I think because that was probably my musical heritage in terms of, you know, that's how I started out, whether it was like working with my brother and then, or working with Gary, Lenny, you know, Jason. I've always worked with people. And I've got loads of collabs going on at the moment as well.
Who are you working with at the moment?
I've just finished something with Prequel Tapes. Done some stuff with Forest Drive West. Done some stuff with some Joe Seven. Screams just sent me something that we're going to collab on. Matthew Johnson hit me up the other day. We've been meaning to sort something out. I'm up for that. I'm working with a composer called Maddie. She's amazing. So yeah, just all sorts really. Whoever wants to work with me, and I'm down for it, really.
I want to just go back a tiny bit to talk about the sort of period after Autonomic, because I think also Exit was doing something quite unique, or at least only a few labels were doing it, where there's a sort of period where you're putting out records by people like Fracture, Om Unit, where there's this whole mixture of the kind of Duke footwork influence coming in and this kind of like jungle footwork conversation. And I think actually Exit have put out some of the more like interesting records in that kind of lineage, really. Even thinking of some of the more recent ones that I've really liked, like the Itoa, which is just like,
yeah,
it's wicked. Like a track like Turbo Sideman is totally different to all of the kind of D&B stuff. But I was wondering, yeah, if you felt that with that particular kind of generation and that kind of exploration of, I guess, like transatlantic conversation again, if you felt like you'd found something that was possibly even a bit futuristic again, if that was one of the reasons it was exciting you, or because you don't necessarily make music like that, but you've released quite a bit of music that's in that world, I think.
Yeah, no, I just liked, you know, it's like when the Duke. Because I don't know a great deal about it, but you know, when I first heard it, I was quite naive to it in some ways, quite ignorant. It's kind of like, well, what's going on here then? It's just kind of, they're taking some old sort of jungle sounds and just doing quite weird things with it. But then I kind of saw it in context, you know, when you see like the footwork and the dancing and you see the way that they marry, it makes sense. You're like, ah, right, okay. Because it was almost like there was a quite snobbish attitude I had as well. I think I had it with dubstep as well. It was kind of like, what's this? Kind of like, what are they doing? You know what I mean? But when you hear it in context, you're kind of like, oh, right, okay. I see what's going on here now. You're just being a bloody snob. So the Duke stuff, I was kind of like, the rhythms and the patterns that they were doing, it was like, whoa, what? Hold on a minute. You can't do that. that just doesn't make any sense. Do you know what I mean? But I think what I loved about it was that the approach that people, you know, the people like Charlie and Om Unit, Fixate and Alex and Ito were taking to that. It's like why I like trying to get people who don't produce D&B to produce D&B, because I want to hear what you think it is. You know, that they were really into things that I knew nothing about as well. And like, you know, records I knew nothing about and how it was having an influence on them. But I was able to connect with what they were doing because there was these sort of some, you know, the sample choices that were, there was that familiarity that was there, you know, like Throwback Therapy, or what was Charlie's big one?
The Love and Touch one.
Yeah. Loving Touch and things like that. Just kind of reimagining those things. Is that, and the rhythms that were being produced, it's like with like Fixate stuff as well, especially kind of like the rhythms that he does at D&B's tempo, which is what I've always been kind of like, again, this thing of like, you know, D&B does have a lot to offer that hasn't fully explored. You know, we know that you can go boom cat, boom cat. We've done that. But what else can you do within, you know, and these guys were exploring those avenues and those different rhythms. And it wasn't, I remember when we were first starting playing it again, it was almost like we were bringing CDJs. People were looking to us like, what the hell are you playing? You know, what are you doing? And it's kind of like, it's all right. You'll get it eventually.
Has it brought you into different scenes as well? Like, have you found yourself DJing in kind of unusual places or like different kinds of audiences over the years?
I have, because I've consciously made that effort and decision. You know, I left my DJ agency because I just felt it was too D&B orientated. And because of the music that I was playing, releasing more than anything, I wanted to be able to kind of play it to more audiences who weren't just there for D&B. And as a result, it's kind of like, I think searching for music and hunting for music again that I got lazy at, is because everyone was sending me stuff. I didn't really have to worry about looking for music because I was always going to be getting the latest stuff from the people within my crew and my camp.
Well, this happens to the big DJs though, doesn't it? They can't, you know, you get sent everything and then you're not really digging anymore. And, you have to sort of, get a new type of motivation for it, I guess.
Yeah, and I think I love the motivation it's given me. It's kind of like really checking, you know, the promos and getting on to good promo lists and listening to all this stuff that's, you know, all these different tempos and being like, you can tell the connections, you can tell that people who have been influenced by D&B and you're hearing them in these other tempos, and that's exciting me. I'm just loving that at the moment. It's just, it's amazing.
I saw you. It's a year and a half ago now, but I saw you at Sustain Release Festival in New York, or in upstate New York.
That always brings a big smile to my face that night.
It's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It was a strange, because, you know, they took me out there and I'm kind of like, didn't really know what to expect.
And it's at summer camp, isn't it? We should say it's at like a sort of kids summer camp. So everyone sleeps in like little tiny beds in dormitories if they sleep, obviously.
See, like my only sort of connection with that is like in American movies, like Camp Crystal Lake and things. It's like, and then seeing this place and like, oh, this place is actually exist. These are a thing. When I did that set, didn't know what to expect. There was so much smoke in the room. It was literally, I literally couldn't see a foot in front of me. To me, when I was playing, I didn't know if anyone was in that room the whole time.
there were definitely lots of people there, I can assure you.
But that's what kind of like, that. I think that set really, I needed that set in terms of just for my own sanity. Because when I finished, the place erupted and I was just like, oh shit, there is people here. And they really enjoyed it. And it kind of like, it was one of those sets that definitely kind of reinvigorated me and just kind of like, right, you are making the right choices. You're heading down the path that you need to be going. You know, there is this other world out there that's open to what it is that you're doing.
One thing that we haven't talked about, which is probably a relief, is the pandemic. But I'm wondering how much the pandemic would have really impacted on exit. I mean, how would you describe your pandemic year? How have you coped?
We've done all right. We haven't released a great deal. We've put out sort of merch stuff and, you know, we've had my album, which came out A Week or No Signal. That did really well. Things have been sort of pushed. There were tunes that were due to be released, which hadn't been released, but, you know, will be released. I think we're just, like a lot of people, just adjusting, really making use of these sort of like Bandcamp Friday things that, you know, were going on, you know, getting the artists to release stuff on the label, the digital things, because that's not something that we were ever really about as such. Do you know what I mean? It's like we always wanted to have vinyl releases, but now we're kind of like, right, you know, we've got releases lined up, but it's becoming more difficult now because vinyl lead up times are just getting ridiculous now. You're talking almost like 20 plus weeks. So having to think that far ahead is becoming difficult. So I can see that labels are adjusting in terms of like you're seeing more digital releases now as a result because it's taking so long to create vinyl. So I think we're adjusting to it really. I'm having some me time again, I think. Going back to the early days of Exit, I think revisiting just releasing me for a while and just sticking with the crew and just being there for them when they want, you know, when they want to release things. It's like, we're always here for you, because everybody's having to work out what they can and can't do, whether they're furloughed or whatever. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, it's having differing effects on different artists. You know, things are going well. This project, you know, came along. It's like, yeah, see, I'd love to be involved in this. And there's the hope of things opening up again. I'm not that confident. Do you know what I mean?
Really?
Weirdly, I'm not also not that bothered. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but you've had your fill, haven't you? You've had loads of it. You've got to think about the 18-year-olds who haven't had their share yet.
I guess. Yeah, you're right. You're exactly right. It's kind of like, I've been there, done that.
Do you think there's going to be some moment like in June when all of these labels suddenly... they've got, right, okay, we've got four releases coming out this month, guys. Here are all your like summer bangers and they will just come out within one month.
Yeah, it's possible. But I think I had the other day, I had three releases coming out on the same day and I didn't even realise. I'm probably one of the only people who can get away with that.
All right, so the final question is to do with the post-pandemic world, I guess, and I'm curious about what you would like to see more of or less of in dance music when we are finally allowed back on the dance floor.
I'll tell you what I'm hoping for is that there's some people who have used this time to really sort of dig deep within themselves and find their inner voice and make music that doesn't worry about what is going to get a reaction. Do you know what I mean? That's what I'm looking forward to hearing, just some good old, honest, soulful music, really. But whether people will play it on the dance floor is another question. I'd love for people to use this opportunity to not go back to the way things, to what was going on before, to not repeat, not the same mistakes, but just kind of like, I don't want to hear any foghorns. Do you know what I mean? That kind of thing in the drum and bass party. It's just kind of like, what's next? It's like, what else can you do, guys? Come on.
Excellent. Honest music, no foghorns, please. Do you still accept totally unsolicited demos or is it all kind of people that you know at this point?
No, I do. And actually, I've kind of built up relationships with people who get what I'm into, like Tim Parker. He has his show on NTS and stuff like that. He sends me stuff and they're like, you might like this. He's like, he introduced me to some people and to Dolan's as well. So weirdly, he's almost become like Exit's A&R. So maybe send music to him.
Yeah. Don't say that. You'll have to put him on the payroll.
Yeah, true. Maybe send music to him.
Excellent. Darren, thank you so much for giving me so much for your time and giving us this tour of Exit Records.
No worry. Thanks. Thanks for getting in touch.
You've been listening to Relevant Parties from Carhartt Work in Progress. If you want to dive into more music from the labels in this series, check out the Relevant Parties playlist on Spotify. You can find the link in the show notes. And remember, you can subscribe to Relevant Parties so that you never miss an episode. It's available wherever good podcasts are found. And if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to leave a rating and a comment on Apple Podcasts. We'd really love to know what you think. So thanks for listening and join me next time for more stories behind the world's best record labels.